KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We are fundamentally hurting this earth, right? Our relationship with each other and with Earth has to include feminine values, and that we have to extract in ourselves. And that is being more kind to ourselves, to each other, and to Earth. That is seeing the interconnections between ourselves, each other, and to Earth. And that has different measurements of what is success, what is growth, and what is happiness, and what is health.
In this episode, we hear from Zainab Salbi, whose work with women on the front lines in conflict zones and climate crisis zones led her to elevate feminine leadership as a model for a new way of being for both women and men. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Taking Wing, Feminine Leadership from the Heartbeat of Earth. As Malcolm Potts and Thomas Hayden wrote, quote, "The true clash of civilizations in the future will be along the fault lines between civilizations that treat women as equal members of the human species and civilizations that cannot or will not do so," unquote. In 1997, the U.S. National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'i offered a parallel metaphor, quote, "The world of humanity is possessed of two wings, the male and the female. So long as these two wings are not equivalent in strength, the bird will not fly. Until womankind reaches the same degree as man, until she enjoys the same arena of activity, extraordinary attainment for humanity will not be realized. Humanity cannot wing its way to the heights of real attainment," unquote. Zainab Salbi has spent most of her life seeking to help humanity wing it to those heights of real attainment by strengthening the wing of women's power. Born in Iraq, Salbi lived through the horror of the Iran-Iraq War and the terror of Saddam Hussein's savage regime. Her family arranged her escape at age 19 by sending her to the U.S. for an arranged marriage. When it turned out to be abusive, she fled and tried to go home, but the Gulf War prevented her. At the age of 23, those early experiences led her to found the groundbreaking organization Women for Women International in 1993. The organization went on to help some 478,000 women in 8 conflict zones from the Congo to Afghanistan. It distributed $120 million in aid and microcredit loans. Little did she know then that several transformative experiences would forever shape her trajectory, including a near-death experience. Zainab Salbi spoke at a Bioneers conference.
A few years ago, I had the privilege of being invited by the Anishinaabe Nation to be on a 4 days vision quest out in the land. Now, a lot of that experience could be experienced as hard. I had to fast for 4 days from food and water. But more than that, I was touched by how everyone in the community had to be with me in the process, keeping the fire going for 4 days, the ceremonies going for 4 days. And it was a show of an absolute hospitality and kindness and graciousness. And so when you're out in the land for 4 days, you're not supposed to have a pen and paper or phone or iPad or anything. You're only alone with yourself and a sleeping bag. and you are to observe everything about nature. And you start paying attention to the ants walking in here and to the birds flying and everything. And at one point, I laid down on the ground and I put my ears on earth. And it was my first time ever to hear earth's heartbeat. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And I had no idea up until that moment that earth has a heartbeat, is alive.
In 2019, scientists at the University of Utah validated that experience. They placed seismometers on Castle Rock, a famous tall stone tower in the high Red Rock Desert. They published their findings in Science News. Quote, at about the same rate that your heart beats, a Utah rock formation called Castleton Tower gently vibrates, keeping time and keeping watch over the sandstone desert. A red rock tower taps into the deep vibrations of the earth, wind, waves, and even far-off earthquakes, unquote.
I mean, I grew up in the city all my life, and despite the fact that I am from Iraq, a country which all my life, whenever I visited America, people will think, so did you grow up in the tents, in the desert, and riding camels? And, you know, after a while, now all when, you know, and with all the invasions of Iraq and all of that, people's like, so all your countries are terrorist people, right? And you're an oppressed woman just because you're in Iraq. Now, in both cases, it's an injury to the soul when your own people and when your identity is stereotyped to such an extent. But honestly, in the first case, I now say, I wish I lived in tents and rode camels. I mean, I did live in houses and cars. But right now, no one has a choice in my home country to do that, to live in tents, actually, because we have an average of 272 days of dust and sandstorms per year. When I grew up, there were no sandstorms, none. We have now water resources in the country are 50% lower this year than last year with the Tigris and the Euphrates. This is so personal for me, but it's also the cradle of civilization where that, right, is expected to dry within the next 20 years. Okay, and the camels where everyone, when I was a kid, when I visited America, people thought that, oh, you're riding camels. One third of them are dying at rates never seen before because they're eating plastic bottles of water. And food production in a country that used to be self-sustainable up until the 90s got reduced by two-thirds within 10 years of U.S. occupation in the country, by two-thirds for different policies that force most farmers to drop their farming. Now, a lot of times when we talk about climate change, now the, you know, BBC reported on the dust storms in Iraq and the, you know, how many 5,000 people went to the hospitals last week because they couldn't breathe. We think of climate change as this, you know, alien thing, climate change, something that we had nothing to do with it. We are the source of it. It's human-created climate change. It's greed-created climate change. It's not just climate change by itself, right? We did it.
Seeing the very cradle of civilization drying up and blowing away, Zainab Salbi knew that as a citizen of Earth, she had to become more conscious in her own personal actions. She followed some of the basic practices. Never use plastic water bottles. Drive an electric car. Do composting. Recycle. Buy local. Buy organic. I'm just a decent citizen trying to do what they're telling me to do, she told herself. Then, a twist of fate brought her to another transformative event.
And then I touched my death a few years ago. And in that moment, that intimate moment between my, what I thought was going to be my last breath, because they found a quarter of a gallon of liquid pressing on my heart, the question for me was not, did I have enough in life? Did I have enough house or material possessions? It actually also was not, did I accomplish enough? And I am a cause-oriented person. That question was kindness. And did I live my life in kindness to myself, to others, and to earth? And did I live my life in love to myself, to others, and to earth? And in the year and a half that followed, where I lost my ability, my cognitive ability, my ability to walk or breathe, all what I can do, all what I could do is be in the presence of nature. And I felt each tree became my cheerleader. I mean, nature, all we know, it heals us, right? We have to eat healthy food and drink healthy water in order to heal our bodies. So, and that did impact me. But I actually felt, as I was trying to teach myself how to walk and to breathe again, I felt each tree was saying, you go, girl, you go, girl, you can do it, you can do it. And I came out of this experience saying, oh my God, it's not about doing this checklist, compost, electric car, whatever. I owe it to nature. We owe it to nature to do everything possible to protect it and restore it. And if actually nature was a lover, she would have broken down with us humans long time ago for being the most selfish, narcissist, controlling, self-centered lover ever. Seriously. I mean, she would say, walk out the door and I will survive. She would have kicked us out of her home. And she's not. And we're taking her for granted, okay? In our human behavior, we go, we are conscious, we're trying to be more conscious, but in our human behavior, we still, me, okay, I'll take the responsibility, I still go, and I'm still traveling, and I'm still thinking of a vacation, and I'm still thinking, like, all these human beings, and I still want to make money, and I, so all of these things has consequences, because it's ultimately not only, it's about how we measure growth, and how we look at our economy, and how we are part of our economy. We are the consumers. And so it's not something separated from us. We are part of the crisis, not separated out of it. So what do we do? So I came out of my new life saying, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to do everything possible to pay back to nature because I'm grateful for it, for saving me. Right? And it became a personal experience with it. It became my heart's journey.
It was as though nature took Zainab by the hand and said, you're working with me now. Friends who knew her work with Women to Women International urged Zainab to mobilize women around the climate emergency. Although she was reluctant to take on such a big issue that wasn't within her expertise, she wanted to know how climate change was affecting women's lives and what they were doing about it. A leading nonprofit group called One Earth helped open the scientific window for her. Suddenly, her worlds came together. The worlds of women in conflict zones and climate crisis zones became one. Zainab Salbi spoke with us at a Bioneers conference.
What I learned is women are impacted the most by climate change, according to the UN and many other studies. And I was like, okay, that sounds familiar to me. I'm someone who understands conflicts. Women are impacted the most by conflicts. You know, 80% of the refugees around the world are women and children. Well, the same thing is going to be in climate change. The first crisis we're going to have from climate is refugee crisis in terms of human rights. And women and children are the majority of that. Women and children are going to be impacted the most by food insecurity. We're already seeing that in most of East Africa, the Middle East, and that impacts women and children. And then I discovered that women are actually innately doing activities that are scientifically backed because it makes sense, which is science says, according to a research commissioned by One Earth, that we need to do three interventions. We need to protect and restore 50% of Earth, land and water. We need to shift to 100% regenerative agriculture. And we need to shift to 100% renewable energy. Now, women are actually very engaged at the community level in protecting and restoring Earth and in regenerative agriculture. They're doing that intuitively because it's their lives that are being impacted, right? Men usually tend to be migrant laborers, and so women are the ones who are staying in these communities. So they are actually fighting for the restoration and protection of land because they're small-scale farmers. Women are majority of small-scale farmers. So it's like, okay, they're being impacted the most. Their work is actually significant and important, even though it's small grassroots efforts all over the world. They are not being acknowledged whatsoever. Like, you don't hear about women's role in solving climate crisis. You don't hear that. You don't hear half of the population, for God's sake, being engaged in this discussion. We're patronized once again, seeing only as victims, not seen as actually solvers of the crisis that we have not created. The last point that really tipped me over, which is when I learned that women are getting 2 cents out of every dollar that is going to environmental justice. And that's when I was like, enough. Because in my world, in my previous world, working in war zones, it's the same story. Women are impacted the most in wars, in terms of victimization, refugees, attacks, rape, all of that. They actually keep life going in the midst of wars. I wrote 2 books about that, about, you know, what we now we're talking about different wars, right? Whether it's Ukraine or other wars. And we only hear about, you know, the weapons and the armies and more weapons and more weapons. What we don't know is that life continues in war. You know, you get married in war, you get divorced in war, you have happy birthdays, you keep the kids at school, you have to eat every day, you have to work every, you know, life keeps going in war, and women are running that life. Women are running that show, the backline decision. In conflict areas in the humanitarian world, women get 10 cents out of every dollar that goes to the humanitarian world. And they are not included in most negotiating tables about ending war and building peace. So it's the same pattern, you know, and that's honestly when I moved from being just trying to be a good citizen by sustainable clothes, you know, moving to have an emotional connection. No. I owe it. It's personal now. To being honestly charged and frustrated and a bit angry that I see the exact same story repeating itself, which is the marginalization and the lack of respect for women's work and women's voices and the need to resource women's ventures and work to protect Earth and to protect humanity, frankly speaking.
Suddenly, it had all gotten up close and personal. Like her work in war zones, the climate emergency presented the imperative to resource women's ventures and women's work to protect Mother Earth and humanity itself. Clearly, flying with one wing was sending humanity in shrinking circles toward the abyss. That's when she decided to wing it. She co-founded the nonprofit Daughters for Earth. When we return, Zainab Salbi works to fund frontline women climate healers and describes how feminine leadership is about modeling a new way of being for both women and men. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. This is Taking Wing, Feminine Leadership from the Heartbeat of Earth. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts, check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most, and learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. To resource women's work and ventures on the climate emergency, Zainab Salbi co-founded Daughters for Earth with Jody Allen, the philanthropist and CEO of the Wild Lives Foundation. They partnered with Justin Winters, founder and CEO of the nonprofit One Earth, which brought its groundbreaking, actionable scientific model and innovative philanthropic strategies. Together, they designed Daughters for Earth as a global climate crisis solutions fund and campaign to mobilize women from all over the world. It meant empowering not only women's voices in decision-making, it meant seriously resourcing their efforts.
Is to mobilize $100 million of fund and campaign to do four things. One, put more money in the hands of women on the front lines who are preserving and protecting millions of acres all over the world and doing regenerative agriculture so they can introduce another way of existing, coexisting with this beautiful earth. Raise awareness that these women, climate warriors, exist. And they're working and they're not being heard. And we have to tell everyone in the world we cannot go about climate solutions without the full inclusion of women. Mobilize and include and invite every single woman and daughter and all of her children and her spouses to be part of the solution. Everyone has something to do. Some people can give $10, some people can give $10 million. Some people, all what they can do is change their own behavior, buy local flowers, preserve the small plots of land we have in our gardens or whatever, rewilding, anything. Daughters for Earth is to mobilize this behavior change as well as financial mobility. And then the last but not least, demonstrate with feminine leadership. Because the truth is, unless we make this century, the 21st century, the feminine century, our humanity is at stake. And we shall not survive. Now, there's so much, as a women's rights activist, there's so much going in women's rights. And I feel like, you know, this is a mountain. A few years ago, we were celebrating for making it halfway during the mountains. I feel we just faced mudslides and earthquakes, and now we're back to in the beginning of the mountain, right? But we cannot fight women's rights by emulating, and we cannot fight for Earth's rights by emulating masculine leadership. We must demonstrate what feminine leadership is, because those who changed the world, from Mandela to Gandhi, they didn't change the world by just being angry. They changed the world by modeling a new way of leadership, and that's what we need to do.
Numerous surveys show that women are making greater changes in their personal habits than men are to tackle climate change. Overall, women are more concerned and believe the climate crisis will threaten their way of life. In reality, it already is, big time. The data are also overwhelming in terms of the direct connection between the leadership of women and global security. As the landmark book Sex and World Peace documents, states that have improved the status of women are, as a rule, healthier, wealthier, less corrupt, more democratic, and more powerful on the world stage. But for Zainab Salbi, the question is not per se economic growth. The question is, what do we want to grow?
A lot of the talks about climate solutions is very technology-oriented talk, right? Let's go to, you know, Mars and extract whatever, you know, from it. Let's go. So a lot of money is going through that. And the elephant in the room is our human behavior. And frankly speaking, our economy and how it is shaped. Because as long as we have an economy that measures success as growth, I make more money out of every dollar I invest in company X, Y, and Z, and I wanted to get as much money as possible on a quarterly basis. As long as that is our measurement, you always have to be in a race to extract more so you can grow more, so you make more money. We are fundamentally hurting this earth, right? And in our solutions is very, I would say, masculine values-led solutions. Technology, the war on climate, the, you know, more inventions. More, it's very masculine values. Now, so when I mean by masculine values, this is not about men. It is values that we can all cultivate in ourselves, regardless if you're a man or woman. Our relationship with each other and with Earth has to include feminine values. And that we have to extract in ourselves. And that is being more kind to ourselves, to each other, and to Earth. That is being more loving to ourselves, to each other, and to Earth. That is seeing the interconnections between ourselves, each other, and to Earth. And that has different measurements of what is success. What is growth and what is happiness and what is health? Because we cannot have the solutions of climate change again be driven by only this big industrialization kind of thing, right? It has to look into the biggest and the most important technology we need, and that is nature itself. Just literally trees, you know, animals, wild animals, healthy seas and oceans. That is the technology we need. And for that to operate, we've got to change our behavior, our social and economic behavior, in my opinion.
Science affirms Zainab Salbi's perspective on the true biotechnologies that nature uses. Restoring and conserving nature's basic ecological services is the greatest tool at hand to begin to restore the balance that makes the planet habitable. And women worldwide are doing exactly that. Zainab has also worked as a writer and media maker, as the author of several books, a PBS TV show, and a highly influential podcast heard in 22 Arab countries. She spent years interviewing women around the world, probing the question, what brings about change? Her conclusion is that the secret sauce is the inspiration that comes from storytelling.
Now, I have lived and grew up in conflicts and all my life, and I have come to learn few things. One, all what we need to do in times of conflicts is to show up. We may succeed, we may fail, it doesn't matter. We must show up, and we show up from our integrity and our strength. And this is the time to show up for our bodies, for our rights, but for our Earth. It's interconnected. They are not separated. And then the second conflict made me believe in hope. You know, people think, how could you, like, you've been through all of this and be optimistic? I'm optimistic because I am a believer that love is bigger than all. And that hope always triumphs. And injustice always gets toppled at the end. I am a believer we can do that.
Love is bigger than all. Zainab Salbi, taking wing, feminine leadership from the heartbeat of Earth. Executive producer Kenny Ossibel, written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Producer, Teo Grossman. And I'm host and consulting producer Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. We invite you to join the pioneers in inspiring a shift to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. This is program number 252.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
Back in the spring of 2000, I was sitting at home in Dublin when the phone rang. A familiar voice asked, "Will you come back?" I was warned this might happen. I had left the touring life after 2.5 years just a few months earlier as a new millennium began. Living out of a suitcase in hotel rooms across the North American continent, from Savannah to Sacramento to Saskatoon, had lost its appeal. But it was Riverdance, the global phenomenon, a show that was hard to say no to. I was a stage manager. I'm not a dancer, musician, or performer of any kind. Back to where? I asked. New York, came the reply. Suddenly, I was very interested indeed. I had toured with the smallest of the three touring companies, playing theatres, while the other shows played stadiums and arenas. They played the big cities. I had never been to Boston, LA, or Chicago. I had never been to New York, and now here, finally, was my chance. My work visa for the US was still current, while the stage manager who was supposed to take that show to Broadway had experienced delays getting her visa. I had to be in New York the next day, and I had to hit the ground running. Having called cues to the crew over a headset 8 times a week for 2 years, I did not anticipate any problems. I arrived on a Friday. A car took me from JFK to the Gershwin Theatre. There seemed to be hundreds of people milling around, each one more senior than me, and each one having strong opinions on how the show should run. The electric fizz of excitement was in the air. Broadway, baby! I realised when I arrived that there were new numbers in this show. This was a revitalised Riverdance. There was an amazing African choir called Amanzi, and Brian Kennedy had been added to the lineup. New songs had been written for them. Some of the choreography had changed, and the running order was in a constant state of flux from one rehearsal to the next. We had our first preview on Tuesday, and I was the person responsible for making sure that the lighting, sound and flying backdrop cues happened at exactly the right spot in the music. Maestro Bill Whelan had written really beautiful new music for these additions to the show, but I don't think anybody there knew that I couldn't read music. I had learned all of the cues by counting rounds of the fiddle reel or by visual cues, but now that everything was changing, I was quite lost. I didn't see daylight for about 10 days. I was desperately trying to keep up with the daily notes. The changes between numbers must happen faster, somebody said. A quick bow at the end of that number and the choir must be in place within 7 seconds, said somebody else. Air on the side of air, I was told, resulting in my almost killing the lead dancer with the flying backdrop when he exited the stage after his quick bow. Thankfully, he was not injured and I was not sued or sent home, but my God, the pressure. My station was at the very back of the auditorium, beside the sound booth. There were two men in the sound booth, one of whom I knew from touring days, and another guy who I didn't know at all. I wondered what his role was. He wore a red baseball cap back then, when there was nothing weird or sinister about such headwear. He also had grey-green sparkly eyes. On the second Sunday after the matinee, I think the producers realised that cast and crew were in a state of exhaustion, and it was announced that we were all off until Tuesday morning when rehearsals would resume. And what did an exhausted cast and crew of hundreds do on their first evening off in 10 days? Well, most of us went to the nearest pub, B.B. Doyle's, on West 51st Street. Somebody introduced me to Red Baseball Cap. His name was Richard, and he worked for Bill Whelan in his studio in Connemara. Richard wasn't really there to work. Bill just realised that every single person who had worked on the new Riverdance Broadway album was going to be in New York, so he invited Richard too. It turned out that Richard had never been to New York either. Somebody else suggested that Richard and I should go sightseeing together the next day. We started talking that night in the bar, and 25 years later, the conversation is ongoing. Thank God for the delayed visa and the generosity of Bill Whelan. So thank you for the music, Riverdance, and the husband.
Amanzi, Aya Bezulu, Esibagabageni. Sikishwa emakayeni siwele njengemvula.
When you've lived abroad for as long as I have, you tend to find echoes of Ireland in the most unusual of places. That was the case last summer when I spent a short holiday in the Dakotas, two huge, sparsely populated Western American states. Even today, they're hard to get to. and are often among the last of the 50 US states visited by enthusiastic travelers seeking to see all of America. In the late 19th century, they were remote frontier societies that attracted the ambitious and the adventurous. Theodore Roosevelt, who had a privileged upbringing in New York, fled to the badlands of North Dakota in the 1880s to seek solace on the American frontier following the death on the same day of his wife and his mother. When I found myself in the North Dakotan town of Medora, I stayed at the Rough Riders Hotel, where the memory of Roosevelt's two-year spell in the area is richly celebrated. The hotel lobby boasts an extensive library of books related to Roosevelt and his many interests. I opened a volume of his collected works devoted to literary criticism, and to my amazement hit upon an intriguing essay on Irish sagas published by Roosevelt in January 1907 while he was President of the United States. It's hard to imagine any serving US president or Irish Taoiseach of recent vintage having the time or the inclination to undertake such an ambitious scholarly venture. Roosevelt did not have any ancestral connection with Ireland, and indeed had made his career as a reformer pushing back against Irish-American dominance of New York politics. In his 1907 essay, Roosevelt lauded early Irish poetry, which he thought had some unique beauties that were not to be found elsewhere. He drew a politician's conclusion that the Anglo-Norman invasion had had ruinous effects on the growth of national life in Ireland, a sentiment with which I am sure many of us would readily concur. While he was busy delving into Ireland's antique literature, Roosevelt hosted a distinguished Irish visitor, Douglas Hyde, later Ireland's first president, who was on a seven-month tour of America raising money for the Gaelic League. He travelled to Washington in the winter of 1906 and met with the president at the White House. During a convivial conversation over a simple lunch, washed down with a cup of tea and a glass of sherry, Roosevelt revealed that he had been raised by Irish nursemaids from whom he had first heard the legendary names of Cuchulainn and Fionn MacCool. Hyde was impressed by his host's knowledge of Irish and Norse mythology. The president told Hyde that he planned to write to American universities, urging them to appoint Irish language professors so as to capture all that was good in Irish life and make it part of America. Hyde was not the only Irish writer to encounter President Roosevelt during his 7 years in high office. During his first visit to America in 1903, W.B. Yeats was invited to the White House to meet the president. The president was already an admirer of the Irish literary revival. Yeats, who would write approvingly of Constance Markievicz when as a young woman she rode to harriers, was warned in Washington not to accept an invitation to go horse riding with the president, who was a notoriously vigorous horseman. While he was president, Roosevelt had the habit of inviting ambassadors to ride with him at pace to Washington's Rock Creek Park, which must have been a bracing experience. Riding the range in the Dakotas, as Roosevelt had done for 2 years, would have been a far cry from Yeats's image of the Galway races, where delight makes all of the one mind, the riders upon the galloping horses, the crowd that closes in behind. The fact that a famously active American president was willing to make time to meet the two visiting Irish writers highlights the fact that Irish literature was causing quite a stir in those early years of the 20th century. After he left the presidency, Roosevelt retained an attachment to Irish writing, especially to Lady Gregory, whose work he greatly admired. He sided with the Abbey Theatre against its Irish-American critics of the Playboy of the Western World when the Abbey toured the play in America in 1911. Roosevelt credited the Abbey with having brought about a revival of the ancient Irish spirit, which is precisely how Yeats and Lady Gregory would have seen it. In Roosevelt's view, the Abbey had succeeded because its plays spring from the soil and evoke the heart of the Irish people. In today's Washington, Roosevelt, who inspired the original teddy bear, is remembered chiefly for his involvement in a mock race against effigies of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln that takes place every time the city's baseball team plays a home game. It is a contest in which, for some reason, the Roosevelt effigy is always an also-ran. Now, that would never happen to Cuchulainn or Fionn MacCool, or to the hard-riding country gentleman of Yeats's imagination.
And I As I rode out through Galway town to seek for recreation on the 17th of August, me mind been elevated. There were multitudes assembled with their tickets at the
station. Anish Chapton Arik, Begin Log Dol Conshina, is Thresh Filabrija or Doig Me Muyol. Spring, it's on the way. No sooner had we marked the winter solstice when the wags, myself among them, were hashtagging grand stretch all over social media. And yes, now it's March. There's no doubt the stretch is perceptible. Here in the West, we watch the sky eke out the last of the light, even though it's often overcome by squally clouds on the horizon. But something else happens at this time of the year. The light changes. What is it about the light in this country that it affects us so much? Observe clouds skimming the sunset, the splintered light through the webbed branches of a lime tree, the luminous splashback from a wind-whipped sea. See how it becomes a refracted glow from golden sand, or how on the leaves of Lady's Mantle, raindrops become bowls of silvered light. The women of my family have a connective relationship with light. Frosty starlight moves us. Texts flit from phone to phone. Have you seen the moon tonight? Then there is the mantra. Have you noticed? The light has changed. How do you explain an instinctive, abstract, emotional reaction to a law of physics? A lumen is a SI unit of measurement for how the human eye perceives the power of light, allowing for the uniquely human sensitivity to differing light wavelengths. How many lumens in the phrase, "I love this early summer light"? For it's true, early May light is soft and voluptuous, caressing white thorn and newly sprouted foliage. Skies in June have a gentility to their blueness, not like the brash azures of July and August. In those months, the depths of nature's colours are revealed. In high summer, as the setting sun rests millimetres above the horizon, plants pull in saturating light. Johnson's blue geraniums and red pelargoniums glow like stained glass masterpieces from Harry Clark. Here, in Northwest Europe, by late August, it's time to ask that question, is it me or has the light changed? Already, a sapphire coldness has crept into the blue intensity, heralding autumn. If we're lucky, the unclouded colour deepens, clarified and filtered by frosty October air. In such generous weather, breathing, although an involuntary act, is acknowledged. Time to stand still, to take in the crisp air, while the turning trees paint their own magic onto the landscape. Light sensitivity, it affects us daily. The oncoming interrogation of traffic on a wintry night, reflecting against sleeting rain on the windscreen, the malfunctioning flashing strobe in the Chinese takeaway, the slightly blurred projection in a cinema. Artificial light has a lot to answer for, except at Christmas. One of the delights of living in the country is driving through darkened limestone hills and happening upon a lit-up home where welcoming fairy lights gild barren trees. Impossible not to smile in the car as I whiz from one island of light to another. In January, when getting out of bed is too much to ask of a body, there was barely enough room to light or inflame a migraine. Those were the dark days. The engulfing days of carbohydrate snacking and feeling the blues. But then the pagan and Irish calendar moves on. With a blessing from Bridget, just before Candlemas, the light changes. As for the stretch, my grandmother had a saying about that. St. Bridget is reported to have said that after her feast day, the days would lengthen by a cock step on the dung heap every second day. St. Patrick said, after my feast day, a cockerel's step every day. That's the patriarchy for you. Still though, grand stretch.
The year was 1989. I had accrued enough time at my German university to qualify for a year's work as an assistant teacher abroad. I felt I needed to get away from Germany, for a while at least, and see what working as a teacher was like. I longed to leave Germany. I was bored by the place. I wanted to immerse myself in Irish culture. Ever since I had fallen in love with Ireland when I visited as a Boy Scout, I had surrounded myself with things Irish. I immersed myself in Irish literature and history and knew the songs from the Dubliners off by heart. I wanted to breathe in the culture on a daily basis, so I applied for a job within the German-Irish Teachers Exchange Service. I moved to Greystones, County Wicklow, ironically leaving Germany just ahead of the winter of what would turn out to be one of the most exciting times in its modern history, the fall of the Berlin Wall. In Ireland, I availed of the year-long hospitality of Brendan, a friend I had known from my days as a Boy Scout. One day in mid-October, I was on my way to Dublin. I had missed the number 84 bus from Greystones to Bray and decided to walk along the main road and try to hitch a lift to Bray, or maybe even further into the Big Smoke. At that time, Dublin deserved the title All Right. The ban for smokeless coal only came in January 1990. The day was cold and windy, and as I was walking up the hill from Greystones towards Bray, at a location aptly known as the Windgates, I kept sticking out my thumb whenever I heard a car approaching from behind me. Presently, a car slowed down beside me and then stopped. A big silver 5-series BMW, the latest model. The passenger door swung open and I heard a male voice asking, "Where are you going, young man?" "Dublin," I said, "but Bray would certainly do." "Jump in, young man. I'm going to Dublin myself. I'll take you there." I could not believe my luck and sat down in this very impressive machine. The driver, however, did not match his car. His age was difficult to gauge. He had white hair and a long white beard, and when he spoke, his voice was the deepest baritone voice I had ever heard. He listened as I talked and talked about home. I was happy to practice my English. With great pride did I tell him that I was playing the Bowron in an Irish folk band in my hometown and that we were playing all the classics. As we passed Bray and Shankill on the old coast road, I shut up and tried to be polite and ask him where he was going and what he was doing. "I'm a musician too," he said, "and I'm going into town to meet a few friends. There might be a session later on, and we have invited a few musicians from England to join in." I was most surprised that this, to me, elderly musician, took such a fancy car into Dublin to meet friends for a session. In my world, comprising student bands busking in the streets and me banging the Bowron in the local Irish pub, musicians were poor and did not drive silver BMWs. It became clear to me then that I must be sitting beside a musician unlike the ones I was used to. I looked sideways at him again, and I can safely say that I have hardly ever been as embarrassed in my life as in that particular moment when I realized that my chauffeur was none other than the great Ronnie Drew. Did I not possess all the records made by the Dubliners back home? Didn't that voice sound so familiar? And wasn't this the era when the Dubliners and their friends from England, a.k.a. Shane McGowan and the Pogues, were recording the most amazing records, blending traditional Irish music with contemporary pogo music? I can assure you, the fabric of the seat in this BMW could not have been soft and fluffy enough to allow me to disappear in his creases. "Oh my God, you're Ronnie Drew," I stuttered. "I'm so sorry. How could I not have recognized you?" He just turned sideways and laughed out loud. And Ronnie Drew's resounding voice embarking into a heartfelt laughter was something I will never forget for the rest of my life. I'm glad it took you a while, because you probably would not have told me all these details of a German student's life otherwise, or would you? His laughter was akin to a roar, and we ended up having the most enjoyable trip into town, in which he told me about the Dubliners' lives, about the great Luke Kelly, and that exciting new poet from England, Shane McGowan, who was going to revolutionize the Irish folk music scene, Ronnie was convinced. Read the lyrics to Summer in Siam and A Rainy Night in Soho, and you know he's a genius, Ronnie recommended. He dropped me near the canal in Dublin, and I walked back the short distance towards Raglan Road and immortalized this day and my unforgettable encounter with Ronnie Drew by recollecting Luke Kelly's rendition of this most romantic song, full of heartbreak and unrequited love. I was yet to hear Summer in Siam and A Rainy Night in Soho, but when these songs were released only a short few months afterwards, they have ranked among my favorite poems and songs ever since, on a par with Raglan Road. And all of these through the prism of that special lift to Dublin by Ronnie Drew in a silver Beamer in October 1989.
Well, it's summer in Siam, and the moon is full of rainbows. Well, it's summer in Siam, then we go through many changes.
Dublin is a city of hidden places and forgotten histories. But just now and again, if you keep your eyes open, you can get a sudden glimpse into unexpected nooks and crannies of the city's past. I got such a sideways glimpse recently, on an icy day in January, as I picked my careful way around the old walls of Trinity College, en route to a coffee shop on Dublin's Nassau Street to meet my sisters. I had stopped for a moment to steady myself, when my roving eye was caught by two nameplates, set high up and a little apart on the wall across the street. All streets in Dublin bear those familiar nameplates, showing the street name in Irish and English. But Nassau Street goes one better, for it displays three names on two separate nameplates near to the junction of Nassau Street and Grafton Street. One sign displays the English name Nassau Street and an unembellished Irish version of that name, Sroid Nassau. The other nameplate bears the same English name, accompanied by a non-related Irish name, Sroid Hubber Fordrick, or in English, Patrick's Well Street. I had to find out more about this unusual proliferation of nameplates. My researches soon revealed that the different Irish name for Nassau Street arose from the legend that St. Patrick, when he returned to Ireland in the 5th century, founded a holy spring along today's Nassau Street and used the waters there to baptise some of the earliest Irish converts. For St. Patrick was a prolific baptiser of the Irish. Legend has it that he baptised some 100,000 Irish to the religion of Christ during his long mission in the country. Patrick wrote of his baptisms in his letter of rebuke, the Epistola, to the violent chieftain Caroticus, who had been attacking his converts. His tender affection for the Irish still shines through those ancient words, written some 1,600 years ago. And yet I rejoice within myself. I have not worked for nothing. Thanks to God, you who are baptized believers have moved on from this world to paradise. You leap for joy like calves set free from chains. It may be hard to imagine such a scene in today's modern Nassau Street, but the power of the legend of St. Patrick's Well is undeniable. It has survived regime changes and name changes, and over the centuries, Dubliners continued to imbibe the waters of the well in the belief that they could obtain a cure for their ailments, especially if they did so on St. Patrick's Day. Over time, the custom grew for Dubliners to visit the well on St. Patrick's Day every year, to drink the waters, to beg for the saint's help, and perhaps to do a bit of celebrating as well. Generations came and went, and the site of the spring became known as St. Patrick's Well Lane. There was consternation when the well dried up in 1729, and Dean Swift commemorated the alarming event in a satirical poem where he attributed the catastrophe to the hard-drinking students of Trinity College, whom he darkly suspected of drinking the well dry. Happily, the waters of St. Patrick's Well were restored, and generations of Dubliners continued to make their pilgrimages there, reputedly giving rise over time to the tradition of honouring St. Patrick's Day, a tradition which today is one of the most widely observed days in the world. The legend of St. Patrick's Well even survived a name change in the mid-18th century, when the street name was officially altered to honour William III of Orange, who had been known as the Count of Nassau before attaining kingship. It is perhaps hard to understand how the ancient Irish designation of the street survived throughout the centuries, but somehow it did, and somehow a solitary sign bearing the old Irish name still hangs in Nassau Street, acting as a silent reminder of that sliver of Dublin's history now lost in the mists of time. St. Patrick's Well still exists today within the confines of Trinity College. It is contained in a narrow vault that runs under Nassau Street, near to its junction with Dawson Street. The well is hard to locate and nowadays lies behind a dilapidated locked door. Centuries ago, its waters were about 13 metres deep, but they are just a little over 1 metre deep today. But the well is not dry, and remains an evocative place of living history, where once, according to the writings of St. Patrick, the newly baptised Irish may have leapt for joy like calves set free from chains.
I arise today through the strength of heaven, light of sun, radiance of moon, splendor of fire, speed of lightning, swiftness of wind, depth of the sea, stability of earth.
St. Patrick. Hum, clink, bam, boom, and we wake to the news. The dingle pipe and drum band have had their pre-dawn parade. Ah, here we go. Most of the government is on a jolly, gone foreign, bearing bowls of shamrock, flying the flag, pressing the flesh of the great, the good, or not so good. The local teens are on an off-license mission. The husband cooks up bacon and cabbage, veggie and non-veggie versions. And I wonder how to get the dog to wear shamrock boppers. The parade is the usual high dough of ladder joy, tots on shoulders, mockness madness, batons twirling, samba beats, Latin dancing and hard shoe jigs. I bail into St. Patrick's Cathedral and light a candle before the man himself. Did this reluctant migrant have any idea? He lit fires on the hill of Tara and gave us Irish and our global family a full license to celebrate like we own all of God's green acre. Back in town, the pubs are blaring Cayley music. Tourists and locals are swinging out of each other, jigging, spinning and reeling like champion Irish dancers. Jesus, Paddy, we'll all pay for this tomorrow.
On this morning's programme, we heard Broadway Baby by Liz Nugent, Teddy's Irish Bards by Daniel Mulhall, Grand Stretch by Karen J. MacDonald. I'm a Musician, Meeting Ronnie Drew by Georg Grote. Shroud Hubber Fodrick by Anne Delaney. And St. Patrick, a poem by Rachel Hegarty. The music was extracts from Riverdance, all composed by Bill Whelan.